Welcome back to Shattering Myths. It's my pleasure now to welcome a new guest into the program. He is a man that those who have listened to Shattering Myths for a prolonged period of time have come to know. He's been our guest on multiple occasions in the past. His name is Jerry McLaughlin. Jerry is a good friend of the owner of Genesis Communication Network, Ted Anderson. He's also a good friend of the owner of TRN Talk Radio Network. And in addition to that, Jerry has for many years had the largest company in the world for connecting guests to with radio hosts so that they could collectively share information that would help educate the American people. And even more recently, Jerry is now a producer and has a movie. And I'm going to let Jerry share the timing, a little vignette on his movie. It's called A Long Way Off, what the movie is all about and when it will be released. Hi, Jerry. Welcome.
Your kind of dubious compliment there is I'm a big fish in a small pond. When it comes to booking guests on talk shows, being the biggest at one sliver of the slice of the pie, it's not quite as big as it sounds. You know, the public relations game is kind of a smoke and mirrors game. They tell you how to wear your necktie. They do focus groups. They do everything on earth other than pick up the phone and calling producers and hosts like yourself to book guests on talk shows. I talked to a guy who was a big shot with one of the big agencies, and he was more or less saying, you're kind of dumb, aren't you? You allow your small-time CEOs of your companies to actually get on, risk putting their foot in their mouth. We'll take the instead of putting the chairman of the board of one of our big Fortune 500 companies on air, we'll put the product in the hand of Mickey Mouse on ice in a controlled environment.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. It's kind of funny. They're taking the company's money, but they don't trust the company.
Exactly.
And so they're saying, right? So we'll craft the message because we don't trust you to do it. And in your business, which was the largest, it albeit maybe a small pond, talk radio is probably the most important pond in terms of people having access to quality information. You trusted your guests to be able to convey their message effectively. If they couldn't convey their message, then perhaps, you know, their message isn't worth people knowing. So,
well, when we booked you years ago, between what we got and then what you got on your own afterwards, because so many people liked you, they kept calling you. You were on well over 1,000 talk shows, so obviously that message resonated with the people. We do that for a lot of people. Phyllis Schlafly, about 20 years now. Larry Pratt from Gun Owners of America, about 20 years. Got him on Piers Morgan, where Piers Morgan did me a big favor by saying, Larry, you're a very stupid man, aren't you? And then it went viral.
That's funny.
All on the internet, you know.
Oh, you're right. Tell us about A Long Way Off, which is your feature film.
It's funny you should say that. First of all, I had a good friend that I had to run by several possible names to, and I had coming home, going home, so close and yet so far, a long way coming, a long way off. I don't remember what all I had. It was like 20 different names. And my very wise friend picked the name A Long Way Off. In fact, he's on the phone with me right now. His name is Craig Wynn.
I would always love to be given credit. I can't take any credit for it because all I did is, since you were going to tell the story of the prodigal son, I said, why don't we use Yahweh's own terminology. He said a long way off, and I've always felt that if you convey what God said, you can't go wrong.
Well, we can plagiarize scriptures because the statute of limitations is gone. they go 28 years and another 28 years.
You're actually not plagiarizing, you're quoting. And quoting God's word is another thing that it's really hard to be wrong when you're saying what God said.
Amen to that.
So
anyway, funny you should bring up the film because unbeknownst to you, and certainly unbeknownst to your audience, I just concluded a deal with a distributor, like literally 15 minutes before I got in the air. I don't know how much the average person listening understands about the movie business. It doesn't matter if it's a secular movie or a Christian movie or a faith and family film movie or maybe a whole new generation of Yahusha movies, you know, whatever. it's all pretty much you need a distributor or you're dead in the water. And we just got a distributor, and it looks like the distribution, the schedule is going to be a lead up to Father's Day, because big father and son reunion at the end when the prodigal son comes home to dad and gets a big hug. Plot spoiler, but it's in the future anyway. But it's set now for a Father's Day release of the DVDs, and then the movie in May, right before the release of the DVDs. So it starts around the first week in May, and it goes all the way straight to the end of June, and then it's pretty much done, except for DVDs after that.
Okay.
I've watched the movie.
It's beautifully produced. It's well acted. The cinematography is really excellent. And the story is closer to conveying the actual meaning of the prodigal son, which is a story about coming home to Yahweh, as Yahweh being our heavenly Father, and of us coming home to Him. It does a better job of conveying that than probably any attempt thus far.
Well, I will say one good thing, one bad thing about the film. The bad thing is it has a slow first 20 minutes setting the characters, and it's kind of painful watching this prodigal son be ungrateful, unhappy. He's got the nearly perfect dad in the film, and he's mildly belligerent, quietly rebellious, all this stuff. But once you get past that, it starts to grow and build and build and build. And then the last one third of it is fantastic because it's got the payout at the end of the movie. A lot of movies, you walk away with the credits start to roll, you don't feel you got your money's worth. Well, if somebody turns this off 20 minutes into it, they're not going to feel they got their money's worth. And that's a concern I have on Netflix, because we intentionally made it character development strong and getting you kind of like to only like the kid a little bit, and then as he increases in character and experience and stuff like that, you like him more and more all the way to the end, and then you're hoping he finally does the right thing and goes home. So yeah, we're very, very happy about the film.
The last scenes, though, particularly on the road where he starts to walk down the road back to his father. The setting for that, the lighting on it, the music, the scoring, everything that's associated with the culminating scene of the reunion between father and son, which is the exact reunion that we would expect when we as the covenant children get to embrace Yahweh. That is worth watching the whole movie, even though there is a lot of misplaced religiosity that found its way into it. It is absolutely worth watching the movie for that.
Since the version you saw, we made some changes. For instance, it starts off around Passover, where the son should be there enjoying the Passover with his family. So that's the first three feasts: Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits. But so instead, he leaves. He picks the wrong time to leave. If he would have stayed and thought for what it was, fellowship with his dad, fellowship with his heavenly father, it would have been great. Right. And then when he's gone, it flashes back to his father reading a book about the time of seven sevens, which would be the fourth feast. And then at the end, around the end, he comes back around harvest time, where you have
Day of Reconciliations.
Yom Kippurim, and then you've got there's so many different names for the millennial.
Sukkah, shelters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, shelters, Feast of Booths, Feast of So basically he's coming home at that time, and then they have a feast. So the feast is with rhyme and reason. He happens to come home then. He's reunited at a feast. Now, his older brother doesn't understand this feast. Like, why is he allowed to come in here? Was I not the good little boy? Was I the religious kind of older son for you? Did I ever fail you, Dad?
Your
brother, who was once lost and now is found. He was gone, now he's home again. And we took that pretty much word for word on the version of the scriptures that you gave us that we put in there. You were my unofficial consultant on that. So I like that. Now, there's some other areas that may not be spelled out or may be off or whatever, but you got to understand, too, the average person listening, we ask for a little bit of forgiveness there because we're dealing with a lot of Hollywood things. We almost had a walkout, you know, the makeup people were incensed that we wouldn't let them dress up the girl next door like a whore. And they were incensed that we wouldn't show cleavage or whatever. I don't know if you had a problem with it, but my wife and I have a no cleavage policy, so we had to redo the scenes, redo the dress, and we even cut out the kissing scenes when they're no longer making out. And the version you saw, it was pretty steamy there. We depict it, we show it, but just before they connect, it goes to the next scene each time. It's like a collage of near misses and lip locks.
In the first of those two things, I'm glad that you improved the movie to give rhyme and reason to the seven feasts and how the seven feasts play such an essential role in our relationship and our participation in the covenant. They are the means that Yahweh uses to afford to the covenant's children the benefits of the covenant. And you're right. Had he stayed and participated in Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, then he would not have been estranged from the Father. So he has to miss those feasts. But when he returns around Yom Kippurim, which is the Day of Reconciliations, his relationship is reconciled and he's invited back into the home, which is what Sukkah represents. And Sukkah is the longest of the seven feasts. So that makes perfect sense. On the small issue of sensuality, God's not opposed to sensuality. There's no the opposition to sensuality is all Pauline. God's not the least bit opposed to sensuality, so...
No, he had a standard, though,
Opposed. So I'm not opposed.
No, Paul, the Apostle Paul, might have, because the Greek culture back then was very laden with homosexuality, and he talked very fondly, I meant to say fondly, of Timothy. And I don't understand. I'm not going to pass judgment there. I don't know the original words, whether it was more fondle or more fond or more loving or more holy or what. You know better than me on that.
Well, since God called Paul a false apostle, I'm not going to afford him the title of apostle. Since Yahweh said that Paul was the plague of death, the only thing that is important to convey regarding Paul is that he was the perhaps the single most despicable man who ever lived. Yahweh happens to be conclusive on this argument. In my first pass of writing Questioning Paul, came to the conclusion that based upon Paul's actions and letters with Timothy that he was a homosexual. But God closed the case in his depiction of Paul in Habakkuk. He refers to Shaul not only as the plague of death, but also as a homosexual. So the case is closed for me. The fact he was homosexual is irrelevant, other than it shows just another part of Paul's duplicity, of his being a hypocrite, because he spoke against what he himself was. Welcome back to Shatteringness. I am Yada. We're here with Jerry McLaughlin, who is a businessman, a man very engaged in the talk radio business, a catalyst, really, for talk radio for decades now. In addition to being a film producer with his movie A Long Way Off. Jerry, before we get return to our discussion, I do want to bring up an item in the news that that affects a lot of Americans. Each of the last 2 days, the Dow has fallen by more than 180 points. It was down by more than 180 points yesterday. It is currently down 188 points. Talking heads in the media are blaming China for the fall, and that's absurd. China, they're saying that Chinese manufacturing somehow stumbled. The truth is that China is now the world's leading manufacturer of goods. It is also the world's fastest growing economy, both in percentage and absolute terms. The most recent report on the Chinese economy is that it grew at over 7%, which is growth at three times faster than the U.S. economy. So there's lots of reasons that the U.S. economy is having problems and that ultimately is going to fail. But the growth of the Chinese manufacturing sector is not one of them. But it also points out the viability of what we talked about at the end of the first hour with IQ Arasuli, that we are so linked to China that there is a 0% possibility that the Chinese are going to attack America or that they are even an enemy of America. It would be self-mutilating for the Chinese to put themselves in an adversarial position to America because we are their largest customer.
But they might attack Japan economically or with bombs. What would we do then? You tell me, what would Barack Obama do if China just blatantly were to try to assimilate Japan?
I don't think there's any possibility that...
Who would stop them?
Well, it's not who would stop them. It's why would they do so? There is no incentive for them to do so. Japan is in the death in its final death throes. Within a generation, Japan, as we know it, will cease to exist. And so that there would be no incentive for the Chinese to attempt to destroy Japan because Japan is destroying itself. What happened in Japan began about 2 or 3 decades ago, where when the Japanese rebuilt their economy after the just utter destruction of it by America during World War II, they became enormously profitable and prosperous. And the Japanese people decided that that life was too fun for them to accept the burden and the responsibility or to be interrupted by having children and trying to raise those children. And they chose to spend their time indulging themselves. And so the birth rate in Japan has fallen to a level that's not only unsustainable, it's to a level that within a generation there won't be a Japan. So there is
be on that island.
A group of a population too small to make it a viable independent nation. So there is no incentive for China to use its military capability to interfere with Japan, and there is absolutely no reason for the United States to intervene, thinking that its vital interests would somehow be compromised in this regard. So, you know, the Obama policy has been to cease considering Muslims as our enemy and to move America's military resources into the Western Pacific, and he has said that he thinks China is America's most formidable foe, and he's wrong. But he's doing so because he favors Islam, and he wants America's military to have a reason to exist, and the only reason it can possibly exist is if there's a boogeyman out there that we can hold at bay with our military prowess. But
speaking of military, what is your opinion of the 200 million man march towards the end that's in the book of Revelation?
Yeah, the challenge you have, of course, is we just don't have an old copy of Revelation from chapter 17 on. So you have to be very careful with Revelation because everything we have from 17 on is post-Constantine and therefore under the heavy editorial hand of the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah, but 200 million man army was like unthinkable back then. Somebody predicted something pretty wild there.
Yeah, we'll speak about who is represented by the 200 million men, if in fact that is an accurate statement, and where that ranks amongst the wars that the earth will encounter over the next 20 years. Be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am Yada. We have Jerry McLaughlin as our guest in this hour. Jerry, you asked a question about the 200 million man army that plays a role in Armageddon. Armageddon is the third of the wars that are fought during the tribulation.
You got Gog and Magog, you got World War III.
The Magog War actually has two hits. So World War III has two phases. Now, in the Magog War, Muslim Mujahideen from the Caucasus region, what used to be the Soviet Union, around north and around the Black and Caucasus, the Caspian Seas. Muslims from Iran, Muslims from Iraq, which are now unified, Muslims from Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, the Sudan, and Somalia. While we're not told the number of them, I suspect that they will number in the 200 million. Israel is completely incapable of defending itself from the attack. Now, Yahweh himself is going to intervene. He very, very seldom intervenes in human history, but he is going to intervene. He's promised to do so on behalf of Israel and his covenant. And those Muslims, who will probably number in the 200 million, will be annihilated. This begins, and it's really interesting, something we would never have suspected even 3 years ago. But it's the fall of Damascus and of greater Syria that leads to the thinning of Israel at the waist, which then leads to the impetus for the Magog War, because at that point Israel is imminently vulnerable. And God laid out that whole timeline for us through the prophet Yeshayah, which is Isaiah. Now, that will still leave some Muslims. In fact, most Muslims, the largest percentage of Muslims, live throughout Asia, particularly in Indonesia, where they still would have the capability of amassing 200 million men. But most have thought that this probably represents Chinese influence as well, since the Chinese have the largest army in the world in terms of personnel. They don't have the largest army in terms of spending, nowhere close. They spend about one-tenth on their military what America does. But they have the largest army because they have the largest population in terms of just numbers of people. And so after the Islamic countries in the Middle East are destroyed, there will be a vacuum of power, and therefore the lifeline for China, which will be the fuel from the Caspian Sea, will need to be protected. And so the Chinese, and perhaps joined by Indonesian and Asian Muslims, will move through the Mesopotamia and ultimately come into Israel, where they will stage a war where they will begin to attack Jerusalem, but they too will be thwarted, this time not so much by intervention from Yahweh, but by Yahweh's return. When he returns, he's not dialing his power down nearly as much as he did to become corporeal. He's coming back as light, and those who are not part of his covenant family will be instantly vaporized.
Well, the way they described it was white hair and fire from his eyes, which is both kind of light. Light hair, light coming from his eyes. Right. I mean, that's the best way they're probably going to describe it. And who knows how it got botched in translation.
Yahweh's own presentation and through his disciple Matanyah in the Olivet Discourse, where he is citing for the most part Zechariah. He tells us that he comes back not only as light, but consistent with the light that would emerge from a constellation of stars.
Wow.
So that's the that's kind of the history of all of that. The most interesting, I think, is how the prophecies on Israel being thinned at the waist, which means that the world compels Israel, after having given up Gaza, to give up the West Bank, becoming ultimately vulnerable, unsustainable, to use Yahweh's terminology, that is a consequence of America's meddling in Damascus and the ultimate destruction of Damascus, where Damascus and Syria become a pile of ruins. And if you look at pictures right now, Syria is uninhabitable, and that's essentially what Damascus is becoming. Yah's term in this regard, as it relates to Damascus and Syria, is that there will still be marauding bands of Mujahideen, but there will be no one left for them to terrorize.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Damascus the oldest continually inhabited city in world history?
Yeah. So who would have ever thought, going back even 3 years ago, that events in Damascus that involve this proxy war now that will bring the entire world into this, the United States and Europe on one side, Russia and China on the other, this fight to the death between Sunni and Shia Islam, a war that the United States started by invading Iraq and giving Iraq to Iran. Who would have ever thought that Syria and Damascus would be destroyed as a result of that, or that that action would lead to the world wars that we see in the first and the second phase of the Magog War.
They call that the law of unintended consequences, I think.
Yeah. So it's the American and Europe being on one side and the Russians and the Chinese being on the other side explains the second phase of the Magog War, where Yahweh says that the elements will melt with intense heat and that one-third of the Earth's surface will become uninhabited. So, yes, it's a nuclear exchange between the various sides and the northern hemisphere is essentially obliterated. And it's all because we're just ignorant. You know, God says the consequence of ignorance is death and destruction. And we are universally ignorant about what Islam represents, what the U.S. government is doing that is counterproductive, what's happening between religion and government and the corruption of religion and government. And because of our universal ignorance, we have put ourselves in this position. And the unintended consequence, if it's indeed unintended, is that half of the world's population is going to die just in the phases of the Magog War. One out of every two people on the planet is going to die. So there's a genuine consequence of this religion, of Islam, and of the ignorant response to it in the West.
Well, when you say they'll die, but you can't presuppose the rest are living, the fair question could be for the people to survive would be, you call this living?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's a pretty horrible time, the Magog War. And the likelihood is that the Magog War is going to begin in 2027. The tribulation begins in the fall of 2026. The Magog War first phase will begin shortly after the West forces Israel to give up the high ground of the West Bank. It makes Israel vulnerable. Muslims capitalize on that. They attack Israel, and that's the first phase of the Magog War. The second phase is when the United States, Europe, and Russia and China engage in a nuclear exchange, and that's the second phase. And after that, I'm not sure that life is worth living here, but there'll still be 3.5 years where people will be given the opportunity to choose to depend on their government, depend on religion, or to walk away from religion and government and choose instead to rely on Yahweh.
Hey, Yada, can I chime in here with
you? Yeah, this is Larry. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Yahweh's word says this in Yasha Yahu when he's speaking of Yahusha, which is himself in a diminished form. He says, he is a diminished part of me on behalf of you, existing as my servant to stand up for establish, restoring the tribes of Jacob, mm-hmm. and to change, restore, and preserve Yisrael. Now, I will give you as a gift to provide light to the Gentiles, existing as I am, Yahusha, to the limits the land, earth, world, and space, says Yahweh, Redeemer of Yisrael, the set apart one. That's Yasha Yahu, 49:6-7. Now, what happens is down here upon the return at this battle of Muggy Down or Armageddon, Zechariah says this, this shall come to pass on this day, which there shall be no diminishing of his esteemed beloved light. And then this is what happens.
Right.
And this shall be the plague which Yahweh shall inflict upon the nations and armies which organize to fight against Jerusalem.
Right.
Now at this time their flesh will dissolve and while they're standing on their feet, their eyes will melt in their sockets and their tongues will liquefy in their mouths. So that explains why he comes to us in a diminished form.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone not covered in the Ruach at that point, they're going to see that constellation of stars coming at them, and they're going to melt.
Yep.
Okay. That's all.
It's a powerful testimony. And one of the things that's interesting is that that testimony helps explain what God has to say in the opening statements in the 17th chapter of Yeshayah, where he says that the reason that Damascus is destroyed is because He has promised that Yisrael will continue to exist. And had Damascus not been destroyed, that wouldn't be possible. So we see a direct tie-in between the destruction of Damascus and greater Syria, which is really Assyria. And the purpose is that Yahweh made a promise to Abraham, to Yishak, and to Jacob, that ultimately he would reconcile his relationship with his estranged children.
And well, there's three involved. You got Assyria, you got Egypt, and you got Israel. And there's going to be a path of unity there, too. Now, my background is Assyrian. I mean, I don't remember if I ever told this before. My mom was a full-blooded Assyrian, as in Assyrian. So I'm a half-ass Syrian. And the other half would be Scotch, Irish, English, and German. So I find that interesting because my Kuntatinta people were pretty nasty people, the Second World Empire. And then they all repented with Nineveh. You know, with Jonah there. And then later on, they were the first converts in Antioch. So it's hard to find a non-Christian Assyrian anywhere in the world. I know I went off the reservation here a little bit, just thought I'd throw in that plug.
Yeah, unfortunately, from God's perspective, there's nothing. Christianity is no better than Islam. So the Assyrians don't get an attaboy for changing from being pagan to Islamic and then to Christian, or pagan to Christian and then mostly Islamic today, in terms of the preponderance of people living in what Yahweh would describe as Greater Syria or Assyria. We'll be back with Shattering This after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering This. I am Yada. We have both Larry and Jerry on the line. And before we go to the discussion that actually brought Jerry and I together this morning, which is an email exchange directed initially at Muslims, it's important that, Larry, you stay with us, because what you cited from Yahweh regarding what's going to occur is essential to this discussion. Yahweh left us all without excuse. He told us exactly what he was offering through the covenant, how we should participate in the covenant, what the benefits of the covenant were going to be, provided us all this guidance, and then told us that for those of you who choose not to participate in the covenant, you need to know this is how it's all going to turn out. And it ain't very pretty. And so God left us without excuse. He was extraordinarily clear as to what was going to happen and why it was going to happen. And so as it relates to those who don't respond to God's offer, they really don't have an excuse. Now, that known, Jerry, my friend, you sent me a short and sweet email this morning. Would you mind sharing with our listeners what you wrote?
Actually, last night I was troubled. I had something just gnawing at me, back and forth in my head. I couldn't sleep. I got up and I emailed you.
Okay.
I basically was concerned that while you do have the profound part right, I believe, which most people have missed for millennium, which is that a creator who made people without asking that they wanted to be created would not likely toast them forever with this eternal damnation punishment, stuff like the typical stereotype belief of what hell is.
The Christian or the Islamic hell is based upon God seeing to it that those who don't capitulate are eternally tortured.
Okay,
such
so
a God
I was
is
taking, I was playing on that and thinking that, okay, a loving creator, a perfect creator, making people, creating people, and a certain amount of them will finally get it, a small amount will get it and think, oh yeah, I want to be intimate with you now here on earth, and I want to be intimate with you forever and have great family time, la-di-la-di. Well, then what about the other people? Yes, the people that, that never saw the proper scripture, never saw the right interpretation, had no clue about these seven feasts and so forth and what the deal is. And I just had to know if, in your opinion, those people would be tortured or eternally separated or what it would be for them, because it didn't seem fair. It seemed a smack of the fundamental Christianity that scares you into heaven to avoid hell, like fire insurance. But then your response to me was
before we get to the response, I don't have an opinion in this regard. My opinion, if I had one, would be irrelevant. The only thing that matters is, what is God's position on this? Did he provide an answer? And if he provided an answer, what is his answer? Before I share with our listeners specifically what you wrote, and you did a nice job of summarizing it, I do want you to, our listeners to know the number of people that will be part of what you described as Latida, the having an intimate relationship with Yahweh here and forever. It's thousands. It's thousands. God says that thousands will avail themselves of his mercy by focusing on, by observing, by closely examining and carefully considering the terms and conditions of his covenant. So he tells us not only the means to receive his mercy, which is to observe, to closely examine and carefully consider the terms and conditions of his covenant, but he also quantifies the number that are going to choose to form this kind of an intimate relationship with him, and that number is thousands. If you take the percentage of thousands amongst billions, it's one in a million. So God went to the trouble of creating the universe and for conceiving life for the express purpose of forming a relationship with thousands of people. So that puts it into perspective. And the reason he tells us that it's thousands is because he says in a previous statement, and he etched this in stone so there'd be no missing it. This is in the second of the three statements on the first of the two tablets. God says that the reason that there's going to be so few who take advantage of his covenant is because fathers corrupt their children. And that corruption continues on to the third and fourth generation. So it is our fathers who have embraced religion who have corrupted us so that so few people know the truth. That being the case, let me read your initial email and we'll consider the response after the commercial break. How is it that Yahweh allows all Muslims to go to hell or to be annihilated? Are there not some Muslims who would have dedicated their whole lives to serving who they think is God? We'll answer that question when we return.